Okay, fantastic. So we have everybody. We have a quorum for business now, and we'll go right ahead with our study. Okay, the topic of the case study today is, first of all, I'd like to welcome everybody, and I'm sorry for the little delay. What we're trying to do with that tech support is get a way that you can see the PowerPoint in almost your whole screen and still see my picture. It's not so terribly shrunken. I'm really much bigger than this little thumbnail you have on your screens now. But the most important thing is you can see me and you can see the PowerPoint, and we can go ahead. Okay? The case study today is about whistleblowing, which means that someone within an organization perceives wrongdoing, and when they blow the whistle, it means that they decide to report the wrongdoing something outside the organization. Now, that can sometimes be the law enforcement authorities, it may be a regulator, it may be a journalist or something, but he makes the information known inside the company to make it known outside. And the question is that proper? Is that ethical? Is it permissible? And or rather, under what circumstances? We can all think of circumstances in which we personally would have to do that. For instance, if it was public safety, we can all think of circumstances where we would think it was unjustified, and we're going to try and use some of the Jewish sources to examine what the parameters are of when we would want to do this, when we'd want not to do this, and so on. Okay? The case study that I mentioned in the title was something dealing with toxic waste, but since then I found a real-life case study which is really very interesting. One thing I'm always trying to do in all of my case studies is to provide something which is a true dilemma. I don't want to do anything that's cut and dry. You know, if you do something that's totally wicked and evil and you show that you can prove all from all the sources that it is, that's very good, but I don't think the kind of people who are taking part in my classes are people who are going to readily do something that's wicked and evil, and even if they do, I don't think that my class is going to convince them not to. What we really want to do is take things that are a little bit borderline, that we could easily see both sides of the question and see within that gray area what guidance we can get from the Jewish sources. So this is an interesting study, which is a case which is still going on. Let's see if I can now move to the next. Okay, this is referring to Novation. Novation is a leading contracting services company. They provide concentrated buying power for members, especially hospitals and other medical providers. Okay, what happens is that they buy from, they go to many suppliers. They make very large bids, which is on the behalf of many, many clients. And then they hope if they get discounts that they will pass these along to their personal clients, right? And these clients can be worth hundreds of millions. These contracts, these tenders, can be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. But this is a private company. You're probably all familiar with government tenders. Typically, when government is purchasing, they're required to do things like tenders. They're required to have an open contract, open bidding, and so on. In the case of Novation, it's a private company. No one makes them have a tender process, but this is the way they typically work in order to make sure that there's good faith in their thing. Okay, this is a true life example. Cynthia Fitzgerald was a purchaser for Novation, and a purchaser means that they were the ones who give recommendations to buy a particular supply from a particular supplier, even though she was not a high executive who would make that decision. Typically, the high executives would accept the recommendations of the purchaser, and so her recommendations were decisive in the awarding of contracts, maybe nine-figure contracts. Okay? And the bid process, as is typical, involves a preliminary meeting where you go and you meet with suppliers and you explain to them what you need, and they ask you what the requirements are. And then people have a period of bid preparation, and during that time, you're not allowed to contact the buyer anymore. In order not to be able to have anybody getting an inside track. Okay? Now, on a number of occasions, Cynthia Fitzgerald was approached by suppliers during the silent period. This is far from unusual. It's very common for suppliers to try and bribe buyers, trying to give them a private benefit that will give them an inside track in this process. This happened to Mrs. Fitzgerald. One case supplier offered to take care of her. she felt that this something was very widespread and should be reported to the authorities. One of the reasons is that even though Novation was a company that bought from private suppliers and sold to private hospitals, the expenses were ultimately paid by medical insurance, including quite a bit was basically covered by government, by Medicaid and Medicare and so on, government things. And she felt this was approaching something that would be fraud. And furthermore, she felt that within the company, she was pressured to give business to certain suppliers because of relationships that her superiors had with some of these companies, right? And so she went to her suppliers and brought these concerns to them. They took it to the legal department. They didn't ignore her, right? If they had ignored her, there would be a more of a reason to blow the whistle because they looked. I talked to them. They didn't do anything. So the only way to move it forward is to go out to the company. They took it to the legal department. The legal department says, we don't see anything wrong with this. Therefore, she felt that it was unethical for her to take part in some contract, and she was fired. And her boss told the press, the fact that she was approached to do something unethical doesn't mean she has to quit her job. When you're approached to do something ethical, you just say no. You don't have to go and tell on people that nothing happened. And that was their position. Fitzgerald, for her part, filed a suit under the False Claims Act, which enables basically the government to sue Novation or the companies that work with Novation. She can't sue them directly because nothing happened to her. The government can sue them. If the government joins her suit and if there is a reward, then she will be able to get a piece of the reward. And so that's basically the dilemma. The dilemma has a lot of interesting things. One of the things that's very interesting is that the wrongdoing is not so cut and dry that you can just put your finger on it and say, look, people are stealing from the government. On the other hand, you see that they announced that potentially people informing the government are really hundreds of millions of dollars, and so you can't say, well, there's no public interest involved. There really is. On the positive side, she did go within the company first and brought her concerns within the company. She didn't go straight to the press or to the court. On the other hand, it's worth pointing out that the company did take her claim seriously. They took it to legal departments, and they decided they didn't have merit. And again, another kind of thing that's basically a dilemma going on here is that on the one hand, you know, she's trying to protect the public safety and the public treasury by saving Medicaid and Medicare millions of dollars. On the other hand, she stands herself to make millions of dollars from these things, and so we may question her motives. And so we're going to try in the next half hour that we have left, we're going to discuss some of the Jewish sources that relate to this. Even when I have a large class, sometimes in the web yeshiva, I give these web classes and I have, you know, a dozen people, I always encourage people to take part, to ask questions, to make comments, either through the mic or through the chat box. Certainly when we have only three of you guys out there, you should feel free at any time to make a comment, either on the through the mic, or I see Richard doesn't have a mic, you can use the chat box, and I'll try and respond as quickly as I can. Okay? From a Jewish point of view, the relationship to any kind of disclosure of wrongdoing begins with the following verse. This is a verse from Leviticus. It's from Parshat Kedoshim. People know about that. And it's called, we call in Hebrew, Lashon Hara, which we translate as slander, or maybe more accurately would be gossip. Lashon Hara doesn't only refer to things that slander somebody, but anything that's likely to cause them harm, even if it seems harmless. So I translate as follows, don't go about as a gossip among your people. That's the first half of the verse. The second half of the verse, which seems to be unrelated, says, don't sit idly by the blood of your fellow. I am the Lord. Okay? Now, all of the commentators seem to agree that there are two distinct commandments in this verse. The first half of the verse, is a commandment against gossip or slander. It's against Lashon Hara. We're going to discuss the parameters of that prohibition soon. The second half of the verse is a separate prohibition. You're not allowed to stand idly by when your fellow Jew is in danger of bodily harm or even his property could be in danger. If you are able to help him, you're not allowed to stand idly by. This would be known in secular law as a duty of rescue. In common law, there is no duty of rescue in general, although there are a few exceptions. But in Jewish law, we have a duty of rescue, and if you see someone coming to harm, at the very least, if you're going to endanger yourself, you're obliged to help them. Now, one thing we may ask, if there's two distinct commandments here, why are they together in one verse? And we find two different approaches to this in the commentators. One person who writes this is Maimonides, the Rambam. In his book, the Mishneh Torah, his Code of Jewish Law, he explains that in the law, in the particular paragraph who discusses slander, Lashon Hara, he says this is a great sin and causes the death of many people, many souls of many, especially many souls of Israel. Therefore, maybe I can get some real time for you guys. Okay. Therefore, the joint to don't stand idly by the blood of your neighbor. What Maimonides is telling us is that these two halves of the verse reinforce each other. You are not supposed to slander somebody, and not slandering them is a fulfillment of not standing idly by the blood of your neighbor. If you were to stand but set to eyes by them, then you would be ignoring the harm that they're coming to, and you fulfill okay, someone has a question now. Right. The Torah says right. Okay, so Richard asked a good question. He says, where does one draw the line? Okay, so there's the strict halachic obligation of don't stand by the big brother is only when you don't have any loss or any damage. That doesn't mean it's not proper or there's no fulfillment of the mitzvah if you have a loss or if you are endangering yourself. But fundamentally, the technical legal parameters of this commandment are only when you don't endanger yourself at all and you don't involve any loss, or at least if there's any loss, that somebody else is going to repay it. Okay, so in that sense, it's a limited duty of rescue. It's not it's not an extremely broad one, but as I point out, in common law, there's no duty of rescue at all, except in certain isolated cases. Okay. So the Rambam
Asher, I've got a question. Is this is there a difference between Rechilut and Lashon Hara? Because isn't the pasuk cited Lo Teilech Rachil Ba'amecha?
Right. So the answer is there's a who asked the question?
This is Bert.
Who was that who asked the question?
That I have is
Bert? Is
there a difference between Rechilut and Lashon Hara?
Yeah, but I don't know who's asking the question. Who are you?
Bert Nussbacher.
Pardon me? You're Bert. Okay, fantastic, Bert. Okay, so Bert asked a very good question. There's two different... The Hebrew language here is Lo Telech Rachil Ba'amecha. Rachil, I translate as gossip, because most of the Shani connect is the word regel, somebody who goes about as a pet, a Rachil, as a peddler, who goes around and peddles his gossip, as opposed to which is necessarily something negative. And Lashon Hara is specifically something that's negative. So the answer is that the Maimonides counts them as two different prohibitions, but they are both learned from this verse. In other words, this verse prohibits both kinds of speech, and the common denominator is that they cause damage. If you say something negative, it almost automatically causes damage. And if you say gossip, it becomes also a prohibition when it is liable or likely to cause damage. And so the answer is that, according to Maimonides, they are two prohibitions that are both learned from this verse. Okay? And in this particular instance of business context, so it's going to be focused more on Lashon Hara, because when you blow the whistle, you're not just saying idle gossip about somebody. You're saying is that you're even disclosing specific negative information about them. As the case here, when Cynthia Settles revealed specific, what she considered negative information about her employer. Okay? However, in the Sefer HaChinuch, which is another early medieval book which describes the the main mitzvot of the Torah and their meaning as he understood them. He gives a different interpretation of the two halves of the verse. I'm going to read it here because we shouldn't go and tell him I'm going in the middle of the sentence. So and so is saying about you such and such. That's one example of rechilut, of gossip. You know, someone's saying negative things about you. And then he says, unless our intention is to prevent damage and to quiet a dispute. In other words, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, these two... Okay, I'll get to your question in a second, Richard. Okay, these two halves of the verse present them for the contrast. On the one hand, I have a commandment not to disclose something negative about somebody. However, on the other hand, I have a commandment to actively prevent damage and harm from somebody, and that may obligate me to disclose negative information. If I know someone is planning to harm somebody, either their selves or their property, their reputation, so in order not to stand idly by as that happens, I may be obligated to disclose the negative information. And so I now have a contrast, I have a tension. On the one hand, I'm not supposed to say a negative thing. On the other hand, I'm also not supposed to be silent when somebody else is in harm's way. And so the first verse says I cannot speak up, and the second half says that I must speak up. And the way the Sefer HaChinuch puts these things together, he says you're not allowed to reveal something gratuitously, but it shouldn't be, but the first half the verse of Lo Telef Rachil, don't be a gossip, should not stand in the way of the second hand of the verse, which is saying that you have to prevent damage. Okay, so now I'm going to look at Richard's question again. Okay, so we're going to get to that. Okay, so Richard's a very good question, and in fact, Richard's question is basically going to be the exact topic of the continuation of our shiur today. Okay, and what I'm basically understanding is basically the majority of later commentators basically adopt the approach of the Sefer HaChinuch, namely that these two things are in certain tension with each other, and that the prohibition against saying negative disclosures is conditioned by the positive obligation to prevent damage, and so we will be permitted to disclose negative information if necessary, as the Chinuch says, to prevent damage. Okay, so the most important comprehensive work on the halachot, the specific laws of lashon hara, is a book that was written in the middle 19th century by Rav Yisrael Meir HaKohen of Radin, Poland. The book was called Chafetz Chaim, Who Wants Life. The reason is because there's a verse in the Ketuvim that says, Mi ha'isha chafetz chayim, who is a person who desires life, and it says, Netzor l'shoncha mi'ra, u'sfasecha mi'dabir mi'ma, that person should watch his tongue from saying evil things, and his lips from saying fraudulent things, and so that's called chafetz chayim. The book became so popular that ultimately, the man became known as the Chafetz Chaim after his book, and among the many things in his book, he gives a compact description after he basically adopts the approach that we've named in the Chinuch, that we can't gratuitously say Lashon Hara, we should say to prevent damage. He gives a very concise description of the conditions, and we're going to talk about those five conditions now, okay? He gives a specific example here, but of course we can extrapolate from this example to other examples. He says, if someone sees that his fellow wants to become a partner with someone in some affair, that includes a business partnership or maybe a marriage partnership or any other kind, and he reckons that some kind of bad outcome will certainly befall him, it's not just something that's some vague possibility, but he really sees a firm basis for concern. He has to inform him, even though the whole book is full of things you're not allowed to say. Sometimes you have things you have to say. However, says the Chafetz Chaim, five conditions must be fulfilled. Let's go and see what they are. The first was, he must be very careful not to decide hastily if the deal is harmful. Rather, he should carefully consider if it is indeed bit, right? Sometimes people are very hasty to say, oh, so-and-so is going to business with that person, or he's going to make a, he's going to get engaged with that person. What a disaster. I'm going to run and tell him what a terrible idea it is. A person should never be hasty in these things, you know what? Sometimes these things do work out. Sometimes a person may have some kind of problem in the past that he's overcome. He may be a bad mixed match with somebody, but a very good match with somebody else. And before you go around, once you open your mouth, you can't close it again. If you close your mouth, you can always later on open it. So the caution needs to be exercised, and careful consideration is needed. Okay, the next condition here is that we not exaggerate the damage beyond what it really is. This is a common problem, right? A person is a little nervous, and you say he's crazy. He's not brilliant, and you say he's a moron, and so on, right? This is maybe a common practice, but that's Lashon Hara. As soon as you've exaggerated, you've said something negative, which is completely not true, ultimately. And therefore, the Chafetz Chaim is warning us not to exaggerate. Okay, now we have one of the most difficult ones to judge in practice, okay? And one of the things that may be a little surprising, okay? The Chafetz Chaim writes here, his intention must be solely constructive, that is, to save from harm and not due to animosity towards the other. What this is saying is, even if you, the information that you are describing, let's go to the next condition, and then I'll go back to this. The next conditions are, if it is possible to bring about the benefit without disclosing the harmful information, he may not tell. For instance, if you go to the person who you're going to tell about, and you say, look, you know, I don't want you to, I don't think this is good for you, and I'm going to, if you don't withdraw by yourself, I'm going to disclose the information to the person, and the person says, okay, you know what, I'll just drop out by myself. You say, person's considering business partner, someone who's unreliable. You go to the unreliable person. Instead of going to the reliable person saying, I want you to warn you about, you warn this guy, you go to the unreliable person and say, look, I'm going to warn him about you if you don't drop out. If he agrees, then you brought about the benefit, which is to prevent the partnership, and you haven't disclosed the harm information to anybody. That's just one example of a way, sometimes you have to be a little more creative. It's a way of doing it without without disclosing it beyond, and then you have to do that. And the other condition is all this, only the disclosure won't cause substantive harm to the person discussed. Okay? This is the following example. Suppose a person is goofing off at work. Right? He's goofing off at work. If you tell the boss, the person deserves to get a note in their file that they were goofing off at work. Or maybe he deserves to get a stern lecture from the boss. But you know that in this case, the person is not going to give them a note in their file or a stern lecture. They're going to go and fire them, right? So even though if the reaction would have been different, you would have been permitted to disclose it. Let's suppose the boss has a right to know if a person is goofing off, and it's going to help him prevent loss. If the reaction is going to be disproportionate, then you're no longer allowed to tell, right? Another example, a person you know is using drugs, and he deserves to maybe be suspended, maybe sent to a rehab program if you have an employer who has a rehab program. Instead, you're afraid that what's going to happen is the person gets sent straight to jail. You think that's disproportionate, right? The same information disclosed for the same constructive purpose may be permissible or impermissible depending on what other consequences it brings with it. Okay? So, in the case of Cynthia Fitzgerald, the benefit that she wanted to bring about was to prevent the government from becoming defrauded. Okay? As she saw it. The way that, you know, the question is, does she have to go and make a federal claim suit in order to bring about this benefit? The answer is no. She should be able to get the same benefit by going within her company and saying, look, you know, we're doing something wrong here. We're doing something that's harming the government or harming our customers. I think we should rectify the situation so that this condition that's mentioned in the Chafetz Chaim was plausibly fulfilled by Cynthia Cicero. At the very least, we can see that if you or I were in that situation, we would have an obligation to try and rectify the situation within the company before we would go beyond the company. Because in that way, we'd be able to bring about the benefit without making the harmful disclosure.
But didn't she, in fact, that by going to the legal counsel and telling them about it? And if you see that, in fact, they're not doing anything, is there, you know, that in that case, you know, you really haven't done an effectual disclosure?
What I think is, if I understand your question correctly, what it means is you have to try. At the beginning, you don't know if it is possible to bring about the benefit of disclosure and harmful information. But if you can try, right? The first thing you do is you go within the company, you say, you tell to your bosses, you bring the attention of other people. If they do something about it, that proves that it was, in fact, possible to bring about the benefit without disclosing the information, and that proves you did the right thing. If it turns out you didn't bring about the benefit, then you tried, and then you fulfill this condition the opposite way. Then when you go ahead and you do reveal it, you've done it because you know that it was not possible to bring up the benefit in another way.
Right, but isn't that in fact what Fitzgerald did? Didn't she go to the counsel's office and, you know, and stay, and they sort of poo-pooed her and said it wasn't, you know, in fact,
plausibly,
you know, a problem?
I think plausibly she did. Yeah, I think that plausibly she fulfilled this condition. Right, I'm telling you all along, this is a good dilemma because I'm not going to do something you can black and white say she didn't. I think it's plausible that she did fulfill this condition. And this is something that also second ethics also talk about. Talk about internal whistleblowing. That typically, even when whistleblowing is justified, ethically, you have to do internal whistleblowing before you go outside the company. Now we get, going back again to the previous thing, what's surprising about this intention condition is that what it says is even after you've already fulfilled all the other conditions, right, you decide this really is necessary to prevent the loss, and it's not going to cause disproportionate harm, and so evidently you now have a mitzvah to reveal it, right? Lo tamor adam re'acha, don't stand idly by. Even so, you need to have a constructive motive. You have to, it can only be that you're going to actually bring about a constructive result. That has to be your intention. Right? There's various explanations in the commentaries why you need a constructive intention. But in this case, you know, the classic reason might be that it's something like you have an equal protection of the law, right? If you have, you know, if a bunch of people are goofing off and you only report on one of them, so evidently, you know, you're not, it makes it seems like that you're not trying to bring about a benefit at all. You don't really think there is any benefit. All you're really trying to do is get back at this person, right? In fact, I'm going to read on in this slide. The third condition included that apart from the intention being constructive and not vindictive, he should consider if indeed benefit will obtain, right? Suppose if I go and say, oh, this person is going to become endangered, I'm going to go and tell them, and even after you tell them, you know the guy's a crook, he's going to still be a partner with him, so you've accomplished nothing. Right? So you have to think carefully. You have to be totally constructive. Instructive intention, you have to have an instructive outcome. I'll give you an example of something which was not fulfilled. There was a case of a senior, very senior accountant at Xerox. Xerox, like all companies, they do a certain amount of managing of their earnings. There's a certain amount of discretion that a company has when they're accounting to move both expenses and income from one quarter to another. You don't have an infinite amount of discretion. You have a certain amount. And companies manage it. Everyone understands that a certain amount of this is okay. He felt that Xerox went beyond what is permissible and ethical. He warned them, right? They didn't do anything. And then he went to the IRS. And ultimately, the IRS did not find grounds to prosecute Xerox, and nothing was accomplished. It's not a question of whether he had the right grounds to do it. In the end, nothing accomplished. So if you know nothing's going to happen, then there's no real reason to disclose the information. Okay. Now I'm going to bring another question. When the secular ethicists discuss the question of whistleblowing, very often they frame it in terms of the following. On the one hand, you have loyalty to the company not to disclose the information. On the other hand, you have responsibility to the greater public that you should disclose it, and they don't, you know, the way that I present it based on the pasuk, on the verse, what I present the dilemma is, on the one hand, I want to prevent loss. On the other hand, I don't want to harm the person. It doesn't depend upon loyalty. It applies to someone inside the company and outside the company equally. But that's not the way secular ethicists, many of them don't look at it that way. They think that the, you know, the unique responsibility is because you're inside the company, you have to have loyalty to the company. And for many years, I was wondering if this had any place in Jewish tradition. I spoke to a number of people, and no one could find a good source that loyalty really does matter. But I think I found a source that did. It could be part of the consideration. Okay, we have a verse from Bereshit in Genesis. We read it very recently. When God destroyed the cities of the plain, God remembered Abraham, and he delivered Lot from the overthrow. So this is a very strange verse. Why, when he remembered Abraham, should he deliver Lot? So Rashi, based on the Midrash, asks this question. What remembrance of Abraham affected Lot? Right? He remembered that Lot knew that Sarah was Abraham's wife. And he heard Abraham say to the Egyptians, she's my sister. Yet he didn't disclose this fact, right? He didn't say Lashon Hara about Abraham, even though evidently there would be a good reason to do that, right? He protects Sarah from harm, right? You know, there's a big, a lot of mischief came about because Sarah was taken away to Pharaoh's house. Yet, Lot showed loyalty to Abraham, and not only did he show loyalty to Abraham, but he was rewarded for it. I think this shows that in some cases loyalty does have a consideration. On the other hand, I would sharply distinguish between the loyalty that a person needs to have to Avraham Avinu, who is the leader of spreading God's word in the world, and the loyalty a person needs to have to Novation Corporation, which is, you know, is just, you know, maybe a lovely company, but their object is just to provide a service and to make a profit. And so I think that this is an interesting source which says that the loyalty consideration is present. But I think we need to be careful about applying it in a business context. Again, Lot had is basically loyalty to Abraham was not that Abraham paid him a salary. It's because Abraham was his uncle, Abraham protected him, Abraham was spreading God's word, and so on. So I wanted to bring this because it's something that I haven't found in other Jewish treatments of the considerations, but we'll use it with caution. Okay, I'm going to go ahead now to the next slide. Okay. So, one reason that we mentioned in one of the five conditions is that we have to, before we go and just make a disclosure, we have to try other means of preventing the harm. And one of those is to give reproof, to go to the wrongdoer themselves and say you shouldn't do this. In the case that we talked about there, we have a partnership. We want to prevent it. We can go to the partner with you're trying to disarm and go ahead and say, you stay out of this, right? That's a kind of reproof. Don't do this bad thing, okay? Within that consideration, the obligation to give reproof was only so that you wouldn't say Lashon Hara. But in fact, there's an independent Torah obligation to give reproof to somebody, right? It says, don't hate your brother in your heart. Surely reprove your fellow and don't bear sin towards him. He's been doing something wrong. You're supposed to have concern not only for the victim, you have concern for the wrongdoer himself. You want to save him from this sin, right? It's the basic belief in Judaism that sin is bad for the sinner himself, right? And we have concern for every person. And so we go to him. We don't bear sin towards him by just ignoring him, right? We go and reprove him and try and help him improve his ways. So what we end up with, if we know in the case of, let's take our case, let's assume that Novation was doing something wrong, I don't have any proof that they did. The case is still in court. If Fitzgerald thinks that what they did is wrong, and they think they did nothing wrong, and I'm not judging it, I have no way of judging it. But let's suppose that it's wrong, right? So one reason that Fitzgerald has to bring the internal whistleblowing first is because it may mean that she can be saved from the prohibition of Lashon Hara. But quite apart from that, even if she has no intention of blowing the whistle, she should still go to her boss and say, look, you're doing something wrong. You're defrauding the government. You're not taking steps to root out this kind of fraud. And so this is an independent obligation besides the idea of Lashon Hara that a person should make this kind of internal whistleblowing. And another thing we find in Chazal is the obligation to protest. Okay? This is called Mecha'ah. I'm going to read this passage in Tractate Shabbat, and I'm going to try and explain how it applies here. Anyone who's going to protest the members of his household but doesn't protest is held liable for the members of his household. The residents of his city, he is held liable for the residents of his city. For the entire world, he is liable for the entire world. Now, one of the reasons that a person has to protest is in order to try and bring an end to the bad behavior that he's protesting. But another reason is that a person is present, he's a participant, he's a bystander. When bad things are happening, he does not protest, then it seems as though he's actively condoning them, and that way he attains some degree of responsibility. And so apart from the one way that you would get into the obligation to blow the whistle would be lo tamor adam re'echa, to protest, to try and protect people from being victimized by the wrongdoing. But an independent obligation would be necha'ah, protest, which is just to let people know this is wrong. You don't want people to come along, even if you can, it's too late to protect anybody. Right? In this particular case, but you can protect someone from getting hurt next time if you allow this, the impression to be given that this is perfectly acceptable behavior, and it goes unpunished, then the next time around it won't happen. And so the obligation to protest is basically directed at the greater public, not the specific incident, but at the greater public, to let them know you're making a statement. This is something I can't agree with. And so this might be some separate reason that we would have to blow the whistle, to publicize some kind of misconduct. Okay? Now I'll bring some another source which is related to what Richard pointed out before. We talked about Lo Tamor Dam Re'echa does not entitle you to endanger yourself. The law of protest also does not require a person to endanger themselves, right? And so this is a source from the Ramah, the commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, who mentions this. That doesn't mean that there's no mitzvah present. It means that a person may be exempt from having fulfilled the mitzvah because he's going to come to harm. But ultimately, if there's a real great public harm going on, then I don't think that a person should say, well, it's going to cost me my job. To save, you know, the astronauts and the Challenger from being blown up, maybe sometimes it will be, even if there's no strict obligation, sometimes it may be worth your job, but it is important to know that there are limits of the obligation. The person doesn't have to suffer a significant loss, and that's something that can also be taken into account. Whether Cynthia Fitzgerald suffered a loss or not, it stands to be seen. If she wins her lawsuit, then she didn't lose, she only gained. If she loses her lawsuit, she seems to have lost a lot. The summary is that Lo Tamor Adam Re'echa refers to protection of the victims. You see someone victimized, you can't stand idly by. Reproof is protecting the sinner themselves, and protest is preventing of condoning. What I consider is the most interesting case in the case of Fitzgerald is going back to the intention. Her intention of blowing the whistle is to make millions of dollars from a lawsuit, right? And the question is that constructive, right? Let's go and read this text from the Chafetz Chaim. He says, intention must be solely constructive, that is to save from harm, and not due to animosity towards the other. So in the case of Cynthia Fitzgerald, we have something which falls between the chairs here. On the one hand, her intention is not solely constructive. She's not only trying to save public money. She's trying to make money herself. On the other hand, it is not due to animosity. She doesn't have anything against the Novation Company. She doesn't want them to suffer. She doesn't want them to pay a lot of money. She doesn't have any vindictiveness towards them. She just feels that the government deserves to get their money. And so what we have here is a case where the competence has to be constructive and not vindictive. And here we have something that's in between. I studied this a little bit, and I gave a class on it. My feeling, okay, I'm going to look at David's question in a second. Excuse me. Let's see what's going on here. Ability is the word. Okay, ability. Okay, at any rate, and my feeling is that the key word here is that it's not due to animosity, and given that her intention is constructive in the sense that she wants to bring this lawsuit to help the government hit things, I don't think that this condition is violated in her conduct. And what I ultimately think about Cynthia Fitzgerald is that she's not guilty of Lashon Hara. She did something that's gratuitously damaging, but she deserved to lose her job. She's allowed to say, look, you know, I was inside the company. I feel doing the wrong things. I want to act against that, but it's naive to her to think that she can remain in her job and still do that. And what I think would have been the likely thing is if she decides she's going to bring a lawsuit, so she's quit her job. She's, look, I no longer want to be part of this, quit her job, and then bring a lawsuit. And so what she did, I think, is permissible, but it's not really consistent with her being a good employee. And so I thank you for listening. I think there's a lot of good participation today, and I hope that you will come again next week. We have done 3 classes out of a series of 6, and I invite you to come back next week at the same time, and we'll have a new case study then.
Will be liable to severe damages. So the question that I have is that really, a case of protest or not? And how would you see that?
Who's speaking?
This is Bert. I've got a question. The question that I have is in the story of Shechem, when they violated Dinah, the Mefarshim say that the reason that the entire community was liable was because the people didn't protest against the bad behavior of their leadership. But under the protest sort of stuff that you outline, if they were really going to protest and face potential harm, then they really had no obligation to protest. So the brothers then had no cause to do, to wipe them out. So how would you react to that in terms of a duty to protest against people who are, in essence, dictators? I can't hear you. Asher, if you're talking, I can't hear you.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, just now, but I didn't hear your response. Were you able to hear my full question?
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, so I'm thinking about people. Let me tell you how I see it. Both in the mitzvot of the Torah and also in the mitzvot of Bnei Noach, which applied in Shechem, there are some commandments which apply to an individual and some commandments which apply to the community, right? An individual has an obligation to keep Shabbat. He has obligation not to eat trace meat. If he's a ben Noach, he has obligation not to eat ever mina chai, and so on. These are things that apply to a specific individual. And there's stuff like the limitations. For instance, if you have a great loss, if your life is in danger, and so on, these things don't apply. There's other commandments that are commandments that apply to a community. For instance, there's a commandment to make war, right? There's a nechemet mitzvah. But an individual doesn't have to go out and make war, and of course, an individual can't go out and make war. It's something that an individual can't, it says there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, right? Well, you and I can't go out and appoint a king. You need the entire people to do it. The king is not legitimate. The commandment to have justice is something that applies to a community. You can't go to some specific person and say, I'm going to put you on trial now for the fact that in your community there's no justice. You're talking about Shechem, right?
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yes,
so
I was talking about Shechem.
You can't go and drag a person of any particular citizen of Shechem before a tribunal and say, why didn't you prevent Shechem and Hamor from doing this terrible injustice? He's going to say, look, a person doesn't, a Bnei Noach doesn't have to endanger himself for any of the mitzvahs of Bnei Noach, right? But that's exactly what did not happen. What happens is you say, look, you as a community are all obligated in this mitzvah, and as a community didn't fill it, then the whole community is basically held liable. So the way I would understand that is not that each individual member of the community is liable for not just an individual, but since the commandment is in the first place incumbent on a community, and it was the community that defaulted on this thing, therefore the whole community, according to the explanation, would be held liable.
Yes, but it seems to me that, again, it depends upon the set of circumstances. If you're talking about protesting and setting up, you know, a system like that where you have to protest as a community and you have legal obligations to do that, that's very fine and well in a democracy. But what do you do in an authoritarian dictatorship where, you know, the people's, you know, if, you know, even if there would be mass protests, if the community itself wanted to establish this and the king said no, you know, what are they supposed to do?
Well, maybe the whole idea is to give the people a credible obligation. The people pay them. This is something meant to give the people a real proper incentive, you know. And then maybe we have the opposite problem. If you say, well, okay, you don't have to really do it because you really can't, then it's never going to happen. The only way you can get the people to really have the guts to go and challenge the leaders is when they realize that they are collectively liable for the action of their sovereign. So. You can look at it the other way also. You know, you have to sometimes create I'm an economist by profession, so you can see it coming through. You have to create the set of incentives that are going to really make people demand a responsible leadership, and maybe this is the only way that can be done. Okay, so I thank you very much.
Thank you.
You
know, I don't know if you're celebrating Turkey Day or not. I don't know if you're a native Israeli or an American, but if you do, happy Thanksgiving.
I'm originally from America, and I'm going to call my family later tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you.